digging in the dirt. I'm digging in the dirt.
This is Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher, where Kevin and his guests dig a little deeper into today's issues surrounding the environment, farming, gardening, and food.
My guest this afternoon on Digging in the Dirt is John Stokes. He is an editor and writer for a website called theprepared.com. He is here with me today because I have a confession to make. I am kind of a prepper. I have started gathering supplies in preparation for events that may be out of my control, so I looked around the internet for some good advice, and I found theprepared.com and found out I'm basically a half-assed prepper. So I wanted to share some of what I've found out by having John Stokes on Digging in the Dirt. Welcome, John.
Thanks for having me.
You know, in doing my research for my own purposes, I had real difficulty finding info not colored by conspiracies, politics, end of the world, doom and gloom, and as you guys put it, the zombie apocalypse. So I was happy to find people that, as you say, have some sane advice. You said to me off air at one time that your site wants to eliminate the fantasy. Why don't we start there? What do you mean by eliminating the fantasy in prepping?
A lot of prepping has historically been kind of escapist. People will sort of go to their happy place. And there's been a lot that's been written about this. There's a particularly good essay on prepping and zombie movies as a sort of like post-capitalist fantasy. And whether it's on the right or whether it's on the left, there's an element, and this is true for apocalypses, you know, and visions of the apocalypse far back into antiquity. There's this idea of a disruption of the current order, and then people project their fantasies of how things could be and how things should be onto that, and onto that disruption event, and onto what is after it. And so a lot of prepping, like in the large, whether it's survivalist, old school right wing survivalist prepping, or even some lefty type prepping, it's kind of colored by that. It's sort of dominated by people's wishes and hopes for things to be radically different than they currently are. And then that bleeds down into the scenarios that people prep for. And so instead of prepping for a job loss, a house fire, or something of that nature, people will prep for the Yellowstone caldera to explode or some sort of once in a, you know, thousand years kind of thing, you know, and they'll prep for this, and they'll put together very specific plans. And those plans maybe are very acutely tailored to whatever event that they fantasized in their mind. And so of course, when that happens and a real catastrophe, like let's say that you prepped for the Yellowstone caldera, and instead there was a pandemic, you may be caught as flat-footed as your neighbor next door, who's not that much of a prepper, because you know you have all of this kind of bug out gear and you're prepared to go survive in the woods. And maybe the only thing that you have that turns out to be useful is you bought a gas mask because you're worried about ash fall from the caldera explosion. And then, you know, if you want to go out in the street in a rubber gas mask to protect yourself from coronavirus, you can. But so there's a lot of fantasy in there. And what we do at The Prepared is we just try to think through what are common scenarios people will encounter and how do you prepare for those common scenarios. And we also get into the extreme stuff. We prepare for so-called grid down events, or you know, some of the less likely things, solar flares and that kind of stuff. But even when we are thinking about the more extreme events, we're trying to think as practically as we can. What would that really look like? You know, what would you really need in that situation? What kind of skills? What kind of gear? What kind of mindset?
I see. So you're not necessarily looking to define what that emergency may be in the future, but how to deal with a multitude of them in a more general way.
That's right. And the thing that people need when there's a crisis is they need options. And insofar as you have cooked up an incredibly detailed preparedness plan for a specific event, you box yourself in. And we don't want to do that. And we don't want to do that to our readers. We don't do that in our own prepping. We certainly don't want to encourage that behavior. We want people to have maximum flexibility.
So your site says great preps are a mix of supplies, skills, planning, community, and you. So what do you mean?
Well, you know, again, it's not just buying stuff. And this is something we push back on. A prepper stereotype is sort of shopping. I call it shopping for the end of capitalism, because this is a common prepper activity. You just think, okay, well, I'm going to buy this piece of gear and that's a prep and I'm going to put it somewhere. And now I'm a prepper and I've prepared. And what we're trying to do with that statement is to expand one's vision of the ingredients of what prepping is and say, man, it's not just about you. It's not just about a thing that you bought and that showed up on Amazon and you unboxed it and you tucked it away. It's also about connections. It's a social activity. It's a pro-social activity. It's a thing you can and should do with other people and for other people.
I guess the best way to handle this, because it's a voluminous amount of information, is to go just through what your website says in the headlines. And maybe you can give us a couple of thoughts on each one of them. And I guess we could start with the same prepper rules that you have. First one is you can't predict what is going to happen.
Yeah, that's you know, very much in line with what I just mentioned about the problem of trying to predict what's going to happen and then preparing for that narrow thing. We take it as a given that you can't predict what's going to happen. And so prepare in such a way that you maximize your options for whatever happens.
Right. So don't get tunnel vision or caught into whatever people are freaking out about on social media. Good advice. Data and reason should always win over opinion and impractical ideas. That's a pretty bold statement for 2020.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, we take this seriously. I mean, if you look at our solar panel review, I spent a lot of time measuring the output of these solar panels and also measuring the light input, you know, with a luminosity meter. So this is a thing that we take seriously, because we don't want to get caught with something that's going to fail, something that doesn't work and that's untested. And so we're always trying to problem solve. We're always trying to look for ways to test things. And if we can't test something, we're always looking for something rational, something where we can factor out, again, the fantasy factor, the projection factor.
And give somebody something practical to use.
Practical and actionable, something that they're actually, that's actually going to work for them.
Yeah, you don't need something breaking down when you have an emergency.
Exactly.
Just as an aside, for instance, you know, here in Connecticut, we just had a power outage for 6, 8, 10 days. There was a lot of people listening probably that were without a power. Do you test generators, for instance, and what do you recommend about that? I'm sure a lot of people are right now thinking, I need a generator.
You know, we started smaller and more portable, and this fits with our kind of line of maximum flexibility. The most flexible thing you can have is something you can carry with you. And so in our testing, we started with portable panels and with portable power banks that go up to a certain size. I now have inbound larger power banks, like the really big ones, and larger panels that I'm going to be testing. So I don't have a specific recommendation there. Okay. Same thing with generators. And I can't really give one in the absence of hard data.
I would just, in general, do you think because power outages happen where we're really heavily populated with trees, you think it's generally a good idea to think about getting a generator?
Yeah, it is. I have a generator. I have a gas generator. And I think in general, everyone should have one, especially if you're going to keep your refrigerator going, keep your food from spoiling and stuff like that. You can also supplement if you're just trying to charge gadgets. A portable solar panel and a portable power bank work really, really well to keep your cell phone topped up and to keep smaller devices running.
Well, one of the other rules was the 80-20 rule. Can you explain that to the listeners?
Yeah, we look for a sort of small amount of effort that gives you the most coverage. That kind of, you know, the 20% thing that covers 80% of the situations. We're not trying to go to extremes. We're not trying to optimize every little thing. We're just trying to figure out what works best for the most people. And the way that I put it with, say, our bug out bag list, you know, I say, and this list will get everybody most of the way there, and it will get most people all the way there, but it won't get all people all the way there. You know, I mean, maybe that's too complicated a way to put it, but you know, that's kind of the way I think about it. Everybody is not going to get 100% of the way there with our list. You're going to have to, most people will be fine with the things that are on the list, but there's like 20% of people that are going to have to tweak and customize. So that's what we mean is by, you know, not getting into extremes. Like I'm working on a knife sharpening instruction right now. And as I'm putting that package together for the website, I'm not focused on extremes of feats of razor sharpness, you know, where you're splitting hairs and things like that. I'm like, what is the most appropriate level of sharpness for the particular tool that I'm sharpening? And then no more. Stop when it's good.
Mm-hmm.
So
I get it. The next one was, it's impossible to be 100% prepared for 100% of the scenarios.
That's right. Yeah, you're never going to get all the way there. And in fact, trying to get all the way there, you're just going to break yourself. You're going to, you know, go into some financial ruin. And you have to get the basics sorted. You have to do the best you can. And you have to have a plan to stay flexible.
Mm-hmm. For gears or skills to be useful, they must be simple.
Here's how I would put it. There are a lot of things out there from the ultralight camping world, for instance, tools and pieces of gear that specialists who spend a lot of time in the bush can use. There are advanced things that people who are really good at whatever niche can employ. We don't assume that you're going to go out and you're going to acquire these elite skills. We're trying to meet people where they're at. We're trying to give them something that is going to be something that they can do themselves and have a reasonable expectation of success. And so let me give a concrete example. In our tarp guide, there are these ultralight camping tarps that weigh only a few ounces, and you can buy them, and they're made of this wonder material. And, you know, they're fantastic if you know how to tarp and how to pitch a tarp and you know how to camp with it, and you're willing to invest and you're an ultralight camper. For preppers, most preppers, the first time they use that tarp is going to be in an emergency. So the tarps that we're going to recommend are not going to be the optimal ultra lightweight wonder tarps. They're going to be tarps that have reinforced seams so that you don't rip a seam from over torquing it when you tighten it down. They're going to be tarps that are not going to instantly pinhole really quickly just from a little bit of friction or from some wear. So we're trying to look for the gear that's practical, and we're trying to assume, okay, our readers, the first time this person pitches this tarp is going to be when he or she gets it out of the pack in an emergency. And we're not, you know, we're just not going to have a situation where they're able to optimize.
I get it. And you're also recommending that, hey, don't just get all this stuff, stick it in a box, put it under the stairwell and drag it out when you have an emergency. You want people to like, let's use this stuff first.
We do. We tell you to get your gear dirty. We tell you to test it before an emergency, but we're also realistic that not everybody's going to do that. And so we try to build in some forgiveness in the recommendations, assuming that people aren't going to do what they're supposed to do.
So you say focus on learning high leverage concepts and buying high leverage gear. What do you mean by that?
So it means that gear that gives you a lot of options. One piece of gear that can do a lot of things. So take a field knife. If you have a good field knife, you don't just cut with it. You can also chop, you can pry, you can dig, you can hammer. So this is one little piece of gear that gives you a pretty wide range of options in an emergency. You can use it to create ventilation by maybe, you know, poking through some wall. You can do some demolition with it to create ventilation. You can do firecraft. So that's the kind of thing that we're talking about. What's that one little skill, piece of gear, bit of know-how or whatever that opens up a whole new realm of possibility for you?
The next one on the list is any budget can prepare, and you get what you pay for. I like what you say here is it's better to buy once and cry once when it comes to saving your life.
Yeah. We have budget picks in our guides, but we have a rule, which is that we are not ever going to recommend a budget pick that we would not want to absolutely rely on in an emergency. And what that means sometimes is that in some cases, there are no really good budget picks. You just have to pony up. In some cases, there are certain product categories where you can get an amazing amount of value. Well, field knives is actually a really good example. A $25 fixed blade of the type that we recommend is shockingly good, far better than what $25 would have gotten you even 10 years ago. But there are other cases where it's like a demolition axe or a tactical tomahawk or something where you kind of have to pay money if you want something that you can rely on. And, you know, there just may be no really good budget pick. I think the same is probably true of some types of battery chargers. If you want it to work and you want to depend on it, you're going to have to pay.
Yeah, spend a little bit more money and get something that's going to last you a while.
Mm-hmm.
The last two of these are, I think, the most important. I said, you say, be proud that you're taking steps to be responsible and self-sufficient. A lot of people don't think about it that way. And they say, share that prepping responsibility with your family, friends, and neighbors.
Yeah, we want people to be vocal about what they're doing because they're not just in it for themselves. You know, I talk in another part of the site about how prepping is flattening the curve for everything from food to electricity. And we've kind of grasped this concept as a society now since the coronavirus pandemic of taking precautions on my own, like wearing a mask, staying home. And those precautions that I'm taking for myself free up resources for other people that need them. And the same thing is true of prepping. If I have my own stash of food, then if there is a run on the grocery stores like there was in the beginning of the lockdowns, I didn't have to go out into that. I didn't have to go out and spread coronavirus. I didn't have to go out and get it. I didn't have to go out and put pressure on the toilet paper supply chain because I already have stash. And so to the extent that you can sort of evangelize this and that you can rope other people into it and get other people thinking about it, you can kind of spread that curve flattening behavior the same way that we do for the precautions we take for the pandemic.
Yeah, I always thought that these emergencies, we're talking about social breakdown, you know, political breakdown of society, let's say if we had a situation like that, that it's best to be out of the mix of what's going on out there for a week or so. To me, it was one reason I wanted to prepare to have water and food was to stay out of the mix in the streets for at least a week.
Yeah, I will often say that if you're early, then you're on time. And if you're on time, then you're late. Because if you prepped early, you can stay out of the crowds when everybody else figures out what's coming. Whereas like if you wait until it's obvious that you need to go out and get an N95 mask, well, good luck finding one. So, you know, I had a stash of N95 masks early because we recommend them on the website and they're part of our preps. And so I had ordered some actually in December because my previous boxes were old. And so in December, before any coronavirus stuff started to come up, I had taken delivery of a nice stash of N95s. So, you know, I had beat the crowd that way.
You did what you're supposed to do is prepare. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
So the last one on this list is prepping should not dominate your life or make it worse. I like that because I think that's what some people do. You know, they're probably just like fixated at preparing all the time and getting every single thing for every single scenario.
Yeah, there's certainly a hobbyist aspect to it where it can kind of take over and people run up credit card debt and they make themselves less financially secure and they actually make themselves more precarious and more exposed to events by doing this kind of prepping behavior, especially if the preps aren't practical. If you're going out and you're buying a $300 field knife on a credit card or you're buying another kind of Gucci gear or preparing for really exotic turns of events, you can kind of wreck yourself with this. So,
mm-hmm. But you know, I like your website because it is trying to tell you like, here's what you can do. And we've already done some of the legwork at figuring out what's good stuff and what's bad stuff and what to go and target to make your life a little bit better if there is a big emergency. What do you say to the people listening there? A lot of them are going to be suburban homeowners, and then there'll be some urban people also that are listening about, you know, well, this sounds kind of like really difficult to do. And is this scenario going to happen to me? You know, what do they focus on to prepare for, you know, power outages and everybody trying to get food and not knowing what the real scenario is going to be?
You just kind of have to cover the basics. I mean, we have a few intro guides, and I would say start there. You want to make sure that you've got us this is something that any preparedness website will tell you. You want to make sure that you've got a supply of water, because without water, you die super fast. You want to then make sure that you've got a certain amount of food. We say start with 2 weeks. Really, you want 4 weeks or more, but start with two. Then from there, you know, you can kind of branch out. You can be ready to bug out. Everybody should be ready to leave home if they have to. So you're going to want to get a bag, and you'll want to start stocking it. And we have lists for that. We have lists that accommodate different budgets and different levels of commitment. Some people have, you know, they want the full loadout. Some people want something that's a little more minimal that just covers the basics. They don't want to go super nuts. So the idea is to just not think about what are the catastrophes that I'm going to face, but think about what are my basic needs? How am I going to make sure those are met no matter what? So I need to drink water. I need to eat food. And I need to breathe clean air. And then once I've started working on those needs, I have got a water solution, some filtration, some storage. I've got some food. I've got some masks that I can, you know, breathe safely through. Then I'm thinking about mobility. I'm thinking about if I've got to move, how am I going to move? Do I have the right shoes? Do I have the right pack? How much gear do I need? Where am I going to go? So those are the kind of progressive things you can think about. And then also, if something is a risk in your area, if you're in California and there is summer wildfire risk, obviously you need to be ready to move, but you need to be ready for the rolling blackouts. And so then you're going to think about solar, and you'll think, okay, well, what if I'm on the go? Am I getting portable solar and some solar banks? Is that good enough? Or do I need to make something a little more elaborate, and I need like a fixed solar install where I can power, you know, like for instance, I have a CPAP machine that I sleep with. I have sleep apnea. So I've got to think about that. I have to have enough solar capacity and a big enough battery that I can get through an 8-hour night of sleep on this machine.
Yeah. My brother-in-law has that issue, and he came to visit where we are off the grid cabin, and he needed a generator to keep that thing going.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it seems to be two kinds of preparation here to me. One is a stay-in-place preparation. Let's say if you have a home and you have to have all this stuff, so you're in your house, you're not forced out of the house, you haven't lost your roof in a tornado and things like that. And then there's another one, which is that bug-out bag. And that, you know, I don't have a bug. I have sort of a bug-out bag, you know, but I don't have all the things that you said to put in it. And that's why I brought you here to talk a little bit about it.
Yeah.
So maybe we should just address that a little bit about the stay in place preparation and that bug out bag. And I know that's a real detailed thing. And by the way, folks, we're talking to John Stokes of the prepared.com, a site that talks about being prepared for emergencies.
So the bug out bag, bug in versus bug out thing is a debate. And our site position is that there's no debate there. You prepare to bug out first, because that's sort of the worst case scenario, is that you have to leave on foot. So we sort of recommend, and a lot of survival experts are this way, even though it's a little more of an exotic corner case, you're going to maximize your options by putting together a bag and being prepared to just leave. So you don't necessarily want to count on the idea that you're going to be driving, because you know, you may be getting on board a bus. When I worked in the FEMA shelters after Hurricane Katrina, a lot of people had to take some form of transport, and they had to grab what they could in a bag and then get on a bus and then go. So you never know. Don't assume that you're going to have control over your own vehicle, that you're not going to be hitching a ride with somebody. So you want to prepare first for mobility and prepare to move. And those things that you would put in a bug out bag, you can use them in a bug in situation. So anything that you've got in the bag, you can obviously use it when you're sitting at home. So that's kind of the first base that you want to cover. And so once you've got the bug out bag prepared and you're ready to move if you have to, then you can begin to layer in the bug in preps, which is the things that you're going to have on hand for like a more extended stay at home.
Let's talk a little bit about that bug out bag, because it's really comprehensive what you suggest you put in there. I mean, between water purification pills, a good water bottle, you have specific things that you say you absolutely need in this bug out bag.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time on these lists. We talked to a lot of different experts, wilderness survival experts and urban survival experts. And we have guys on our own staff that are wilderness medicine experts and things like this. So we spent a lot of time trying to think through levels and, you know, a core starting loadout, and then something that is a little more involved, and then something that's just the max to give people options. And again, we're trying to cover those basic needs. We want people to be able to breathe. We want them to be able to drink water and hydrate. We want them to be able to eat food. Then we want them to be able to have shelter and stay out of the sun or the rain. So there's a tarp in there. We want them to be able to charge their gadgets. So there's a solar panel in there and a charger. So we're kind of trying to go through all the, you need light. You may need to make a fire for some reason. You're going to want to have documents, cash. And so all the things that are in there are thought through, and they come from, you know, experiences of different survival instructors and also people that do a lot of traveling, people that, like I said, do emergency medicine, firefighters, things like that.
Yeah, it's quite a voluminous list. I would suggest that if you really want to get into details, you can go to the site and look at all that stuff. We just spent too much time talking about all the different things that you could have in a bug out bag. Now, let's say we're staying inside. We're hunkering down because it's a mess out there and we're trying to protect our family. The food would come in first. Well, I guess water comes in first because you can survive without food for a little bit longer than you can without water. That your site made me rethink my water storage stuff, and I've gotten big containers now and have them stored in the basement because you say we need at least a gallon of water per person per day.
That's right. And too many people have a plan to drink out of the back of the toilet or out of their hot water heater. And we try to tell you, you know, look, don't do that. Don't assume that your hot water heater is not going to be damaged. Don't assume that there's not going to be some area problem with the local water purification plant when, you know, it turns out that it's not working properly and you can't safely drink that stuff. Don't take chances with your water supply. The containers are very cheap. Buy them. If you have the space, buy them and stack them and fill them with clean water, and then have an actual supply of water on hand that is specifically designated as drinking water. Now, some people do have space concerns, but you can usually make it work.
Yep, I just did it. And I'm happy with what I got. By the way, food next would be, this is the one that's kind of tricky, you know? I mean, do you buy freeze-dried food in the big container? Do you get lots of soups that are dried, you know, and you use your water? I mean, and also, how long can it last and the rotation of it? You know, these are all questions you addressed on the website, which I find really helpful because I think most people will put it on the shelf and they'll stay there and then you go to get it and it's already expired.
Yeah, food is a constant struggle. It's a constant battle. It's something that is top of mind for everybody that's preparing. And you just have to stay on top of it the same way you do your finances or your credit card bill. If you just kind of put it out of mind, then you're gonna put yourself in a bind. So it's just one of those things. And pardon me, as Americans, we're not used to thinking about food in that way. Food is a kind of convenience thing. People go to the store every day now, and they go to the grocery store, and they don't keep as much food on hand. I mean, when I was growing up, we went to the grocery store maybe once a week, but that's, those days are gone. People go on a regular basis. So there's a little bit of pushing people to rethink those habits and those expectations that I can go to the grocery store every day and it's fine. You know, we want people to build up a stash of food that they're going to rotate. And also, yeah, have a stash of long-term storage food. The freeze-dried stuff will last 25 or 30 years if it's stored properly. You don't need a lot of it, but it's good to have a certain amount.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I think people right now, because of the COVID-19 thing and the run on the stores, I mean, nobody ever thought they would ever see the day when paper towels and toilet paper were running out all the time. I mean, it showed a little bit of a weakness in our supply chain.
Yeah, that's ongoing. There are still weaknesses in the food supply chain. And I've been working on a post for like 2 days about food supply issues. And we started on this early on the website, on the blog, covering the coming shortages. And then the shortages actually came. And it's important to know that the shortages that we've seen so far are mostly around packaging and processing and distribution. They're not shortages yet from, there's just not enough of some crop or, you know, some type of animal or something like that. They're shortages because, like, the current canned food shortages are from an aluminum shortage. There's shortages that are around because people in these chicken processing plants got COVID-19 and the whole plant shut down for a week. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff that's working its way through the system because there's so many points in the food supply chain that can fail and that are vulnerable to COVID.
Let's talk a little bit about money. You know, I had somebody complain to me, oh, I couldn't believe when the electricity went out, I couldn't get anything out of the ATM. I had no money, and I'm never going to go without money. What do you think about that? And then what do you think about how much you should have on it in hand? You know, and should it be cash, silver, gold? I mean, what are we talking about when we're talking about money in a situation like this?
Yeah, I don't have a good recommendation for how much to have on hand. Although if you can manage to have a month's worth of expenses in cash, or even just a week's worth of expenses in cash, that'd be great. I mean, I would think about it more in terms of, what do I typically spend in a week? What do I typically spend in a month? Because everybody's at different levels and lives in different places. And, you know, I would think about it more along those lines as you're trying to think how much money you can kind of safely put aside in store. And I do like cash. We don't typically recommend gold or silver coins or anything like that at the website. If you're thinking about sort of really long-term storage of wealth in a way that's like portable and immune to financial system collapse, there is some promise with some of like Bitcoin, some of the cryptocurrencies. That stuff is, you know, all the reasons that make it popular for drug dealers and terrorists and stuff make it kind of interesting for preppers, because it's a way to move wealth across national borders. Like, we have paid foreign contractors before in Bitcoin. I've been at businesses that have done that because in their country, maybe they had, one of them was a Venezuelan contractor who was dealing with inflation in his home country. And so we just paid him in Bitcoin. So there are things like that that you can do, but really the core thing is to, everybody's going to tell you, get out of debt, pay off high interest credit card loans first, and then kind of work your way down and focus on working your way out of debt. And then also focus on keeping a week, 2 weeks, a month's worth of cash on hand.
Mm-hmm. A couple of $1,000 in cash.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. But what about bugging out with it? Should you have to have a bug out bag for all your, like, your deeds and your contracts and your will and the money you have in the safe? Is that a different bag, or is that go in the same bag?
All this stuff should go in the same bag. You know, you can nowadays, with the magic of cell phones, you can take pictures of all that stuff and have copies of those documents electronically. If we're ever in a world where an electronic copy is not going to cut it, then probably the paper copy isn't going to do you much good either.
So back it up on a thumb drive or something. So also, when we're preparing for this, how much do you think people should spend? I know it's budget related, but how much do you think in general people should expect to spend on a good bug out bag?
This is a very, very difficult question of how much people should be spending on prepping. I myself, before all of this COVID stuff, I took it as a hobby. I'm not a person that has a lot of hobbies. I don't golf. And so for me, I thought, okay, well, what would I spend if I was a golfer? What would I spend if I was into, you know, riding dirt bikes or some other kind of hobby? I'm going to just put that money towards preparedness. So that's kind of how I budgeted, you know, thought about the budgeting. I thought for people that are in my rough, you know, income class that do golfing, what are they spending on membership fees, gear, dues, stuff like that. And that was my comparable. Other people's comparables are going to be insurance. They're going to think, okay, well, I'm spending X amount of dollars a year on car and home insurance in case my house burns down. I'm going to try and match that with catastrophe insurance in the form of preps. And so that's a model people can use. So I would say find a model like that, whether it's a model of this is my hobby that I'm doing, or this is insurance that I'm purchasing, and kind of try and keep it within those bounds.
That's a good answer, John, but you really didn't tell us, like, you know, what's a bare minimum bug out bag going to cost me?
You know, I don't know that off the top of my head.
$300?
I would say, yeah, I would say you could probably get something for about $300. You know, spoiler alert, this is something we're working on, which is, you know, bags at different price levels. We have bags at different gear levels, but we have a tool on the website called Kit Builder. And so we have these things assembled in these kits, and it's an alternative to using a spreadsheet. And you can kind of swap gear in and out and change the prices. Mm-hmm. And so right now our preferred way of telling you to deal with this is to go to our list and then find that kit and then copy it and make an account and then start to tweak, you know, based on your own budget. I would say you could probably get into a pretty decent minimum bug out bag especially if you bought a used backpack or you adapted a backpack you already have, you know, for under $500.
And you were talking now, the $500 would be all the gear that's in the bag. We're not just talking about the bag.
Yeah, the gear that's in the bag and a bag that you got, you know, from Army Surplus or that you dug out of your garage, an old camping bag or something like that.
So that's like a good medical kit, a knife, water bottle, and some food, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's your, like, a general top-of-the-end bug-out bag going to cost, and then what can you get away with?
So if you're gonna buy everything with all of our main picks and you were to go through the site and you were to populate the bug out bag, the ideal way that we would want to do it, and we have a kit for this using our Kit Builder tool. And if you check that kit, it's called Bug Out Bag by Priority Levels, you'll see that the whole total is $2,705. So that's with all the bells and whistles and none of the budget options, we're not actually doing all the Gucci upgrade options, but with the main picks and everything that you'd want, it's about 42 pounds and $2,700. If you look at just the level one kit, which is the sort of bare minimum bug out kit. And again, all the picks are the main picks that we have, and none of them are budget picks. That clocks in at $971, so a little under a grand for that core level one kit. Now, if you went through that kit, and for each of the picks, you threw out the pick that we have, and you went to the relevant guide on our site, and you picked the budget option instead of, you know, our favorite, you could save a ton of money, and you could probably get that down to about $500. That's my back of the envelope guess. So if you took, for instance, the knife, that's a $110 survival knife, and you put in the $25 one, you're going to save. The Leatherman Wave Plus, you could get a much cheaper multi-tool that's on the list, save money there. The tarp that we have, you could get the budget tarp, you could save money. So there's a lot of things that you could do, and I don't characterize this as cutting corners, because to be clear, the $25 knife that we recommend is very, very good, and it will absolutely work. You don't need to buy the $110 one. The $110 one is amazing, but the $25 one will get it done. So you can certainly put together a very serviceable bag, I would think, for between $500 and $600, especially if you used your own backpack that you got, you know, out of your garage or a work pack or something like that, and didn't have to show off for the backpack.
And to be clear, the prepared.com is not selling a bag for $900 with everything in it. You have to pick and choose from what you're recommending and put it together yourself, but it's going to cost you about $900.
Yeah, we're not selling this bag. We don't have this bag on the website. You know, you can't buy this from us. These are our picks for things that you'd have to buy from. You can source them from Amazon. You can source them from, you know, a number of places. Some of the stuff that we have is a little bit specialty, so it's not on Amazon or some of these other websites. You have to go to a specific site for it. But
mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I got. Very good. It's really great information. I mean, you can spend quite a few days going through all the stuff you've assembled already. So, and like I said, once again, it's not this doom and gloom and, you know, the end of the world apocalypse stuff or the zombie apocalypse. It is definitely same kind of even-handed information is what I saw. And that's why John Stokes is here from theprepared.com. Let me ask you, you have a thing on the site that says what you should do, share or hide your prepping. You want to expound on that a little bit? Because I find that very interesting. A lot of people say, well, I got mine.
The classic prepper mindset is to hide your prepping because you don't want random people showing up and taking your stuff, you know, when catastrophe strikes. And we're more of the kind of pro-social mindset of go ahead and share that you're a prepper and share your prepping and try and rope other people into it so that you have that resiliency and redundancy that's a community resiliency. But there are times, I think, when it's probably wise to keep it under wraps. So, you know, if there's a big blackout and you're the only house on the block that has a generator running, you know, and it's an extended blackout and you've got, you know, lights on in your yard and all that, I mean, you may make yourself a target. This is not theoretical. There's a post on Reddit and the Reddit prepper subreddit about exactly this. There was a guy who was like, yeah, man, the neighbors, I could see that they just quietly put up a really tall fence and they installed a generator and, you know, all this other kind of stuff. And, you know, there were people sharing stories of like, yeah, you know, this one house on the block was lit up like Christmas and like nobody else had power for miles around.
So. Might be a good idea to turn the lights off on the outside.
Exactly.
Now, you know what? Rub it in people's faces. In fact, when we had Sandy here, I was out for 12 days, and that's why I have a generator that I can plug directly in the house and run the whole house. So I put that switch in, but I also shared my generator for charging everything under the sun. You know, if they wanted to come over and plug it in, I allowed that to happen. And I believe with you too. I think maybe we could talk about that right now, is that you also say not only is her prep a mix of supplies, skills, and planning, but it's community. So maybe we can talk a little bit about that, because to me, that's a really important thing, being able to survive because you help each other.
Yeah, absolutely. I would much rather have my neighbors like with me than against me in a disaster. I don't think there's any question that it's better to be somebody that has that community support and an extended network. And I see a lot of this right now going on. There's a lot of activity in prepper groups around organizing in the near term, these different prepper networks and prepper communities in certain locations in case things get, you know, even worse for whatever reason.
And you know, the site says prepping should make your life better, not worse. How could preparing make your life worse?
Yeah, if you overspend on it, if you just, you know, kind of doom scroll and go into this bunker mentality and you isolate yourself and you run up a lot of debt buying stuff, that would, I think, definitely count as a downgrade, as a life downgrade, where you know, you might have been better off without getting into it at all.
I get it. So let's wrap it up here. If you could leave the listener with just one bit of advice on getting started to prepare for the unexpected, what would that be? What do you have to say to people out there?
I would say that it's not too late. People get into kind of a panic where they think, oh my goodness, things have already gotten so bad, or this catastrophe is upon us. Like it's too late for me to do anything. And it's not too late. And it's also not too late to start small. You don't have to even spend $500 to get, for instance, a blackout kit. You know, I have a blog post where there's a $120 blackout kit that includes food and water preps for 2 days. So you don't have to spend a ton of money to just get started and to have something that's going to make a meaningful difference. At $120, if you're in California and you've bought that solar panel and that charger, and you've got, you know, a block of Datrex bars and some water, if the power goes out for 3 days, you know, that could make a meaningful difference in your ability to maintain cell phone access and maintain your sanity. So you can always get started. It's never too late, and you can still start small and start building your way up.
If somebody had to make a choice between the bug in situation or the bug out, what do you think is slightly more important?
I think that it's important to be ready to leave. The decision to leave or to not leave is, in a lot of disaster situations, the one that makes the difference between a really good outcome and a really bad outcome. And also timing is important too. And so you don't want to box yourself in where you cannot leave. And so I would say, if you're going to prioritize, obviously you want to prepare for both. You want to prepare to bug out, and you want to prepare to bug in. But if you have to address one thing first, I would say address the bug out first. Even if your plan is to stay in, everybody's plan should be to bug in. That should be everybody's plan, to stay put. But you need to have that option to jump in the car and go, or to leave on foot, or to leave on a bus or a train or whatever, or an airplane.
So you got to take something with you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, John Stokes of theprepared.com. Thank you so much for coming on and sort of stimulating this conversation. Maybe people think a little bit about being prepared.
Thank you.
Digging in the dirt. Digging in the dirt.
You've been listening to Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher.